After the end of the First World War, the German dealer Wilhelm Uhde came back to Paris after being expelled and expropriated, like any other German living on French soil, in 1914. One day, he went up to see an exhibition of his former protégé Henri Rousseau's paintings that was held in a building close to the Boulevard des Capucines, which you can see on the left of the slide. A French man recognized him and asked him which paintings he loved most. Uhde pointed to the painting of a woman in a red dress in the forest he had bought before the war for 40 francs from a washer. The painting, which is on the right side of the slide, had been confiscated after the outbreak of the war. The French gentleman told Uhde he could buy it back for 300,000 francs. This anecdote vividly illustrates one of the main consequences of the expulsion and expropriation of dealers from the German Kaiserreich and the Austro-Hungarian Empire of 1914. While researching on France for my PhD project on the history of the European art market during the First World War, I stumbled across this episode, which has not received much scholarly attention. Some very prominent dealers like Daniel Henrik Hanweiler and Wilhelm Uhde mention their confiscation experiences in their memoirs. But there is no scholarly study on German-speaking art dealers in Paris as a community, and no study on the wide-ranging consequences of these measures. This paper reflects on how historians and art historians can use the expulsion of these dealers to reflect on the nexus foreign money and urban space. The expulsion of German-speaking dealers allowed the French state to appropriate their capital. But the fact that many of them would never come back to Paris was a substantial loss to the market as a whole, as a study of sale records shows. This paper also hopes to offer a methodological case study to reflect on the type of sources that can be used to reconstruct the presence and absence of a community and to analyze the consequences of exile and expulsion on a space. The last decades of the 19th century have always been so dominated by French cultural influences that they've become universally known as the fin de siècle, a term that was meant to encompass all the atmosphere and spirit of this period. Paris was the thriving center from which this spirit seemed to radiate. Yet the cultural life of Paris was in itself shaped by foreign influences and influxes. Few communities were as present both in the artistic and business life of Paris before the First World War as German-speaking art dealers, which is dealers from the German Kaiserreich and Austria-Hungary. The official bulletin of the syndical chambers of art and art objects dealers in Paris shows how the majority of non-Francophone dealers in Paris stemmed from these areas of Europe. While many of these names are now forgotten, other names, such as that of Jacques Seligman, have become the epitome of French art dealing. Seligman belonged to a generation of Germanophone cosmopolitans who shaped the French art market at the turn of the century. A younger generation, represented by Daniel Henrik Hanweiler, considerably shaped European art production from Paris. Especially for the older generation, a remark concerning the notion of exile and expulsion has to be made. These figures left a unified Germany. A striking similarity between the biographies of figures as different as Jacques Seligman and Wilhelm Uhde is their problematic relationship with the new, for the time clearly, Prussian Germany. Their voluntary exile from German society led them to Paris. They migrated to a country and into an art world which allowed them to become successful, yet was paradoxically drenched in very strong anti-Semitism and anti-German feelings. These dealers managed to carve out their own careers in society, which, as studies on the history of migration in the late 19th century have shown, deemed cultural differences as extremely important for economic and social success. So on the right side of the slide, you can see the official expulsion decree promulgated in four, 1914 by the French state. German-speaking dealers, along clearly with Ottoman dealers, were expropriated and their possessions were auctioned off at the Parisian auction house, Hôtel d'Or. So a depiction of an auction is at the bottom right corner of the slide. The sales of confiscated material would start properly after 1918 and would continue up until 1924. During the course of my PhD, I've constructed three databases containing the results for over 2,600 auctions held across Europe. And I have all the records for sale held in Paris between 1910 and 1925. This allows me to say that the French market went through a phase of crisis after 1914. And more importantly, this allows me to retrace how much German capital was appropriated by the state by looking at the auctions of confiscated material. These sources are often neglected by historians and art historians, but prices are incredibly important and even essential. Specifically in this case, auction records are the first and only source of information about some mid-brow dealers. Statistics based on these records tell us something very interesting. Taking a random year like 1921, shows that roughly a tenth of the revenue from auctions at the war came from sales of confiscated material. So 10% of a yearly revenue of 60 million francs in 1921 came from German-speaking dealers. The more striking aspect is that the auctions of confiscated material brought on average 50% more revenue than average auctions of French material in the same year. The money that the French state gained from these auctions in the short term was money it lost in the long term, because what was being sold was the capital that these individuals had been able to amass. And this was ultimately a measure of how good they were as businessmen. The loss was important for the business life of Paris because many of these dealers did not come back. In 1920, the letters W and K in the list of addresses of the Parisian art world published in the Annuaire of Dealers had lost respectively 40% and 26% of their German names compared to 1914. While 2 years after the war, Germans had not completely disappeared from the records, it is clear that an important part of the community had been decimated. This illustrates the breakdown of personal connections, international networks, and circuits of commerce that followed the outbreak of the First World War. The war was the biggest disruption to world trade in a world which was, up until 1914, globalized. For a market which was integrated, meaning that prices were similar for the same merchandise across different locations, as the European art market was, the consequences were serious. The more so since interactions with high quality goods were, as much as they are now, based on personal connections. And the degree of embeddedness in a network was a guarantee for success for dealers, as a series of economic studies on networks has shown. Networks are part of what economic historians define as the negotiated space of market culture. Market culture is the abstract space between makers and users of goods and among those who sell and design the material culture of their society. Therefore, what this historical episode tells us about Paris is that the market culture of the city became less cosmopolitan. This observation fits into studies which deal with the internationality of Paris and thematize how the city became less cosmopolitan in certain aspects, in certain regards. For instance, Béatrice Joyeux-Prunel shows how after 1914, the Parisian art world became much less cosmopolitan by looking at the lists of the contributors to art journals and newspapers and noticing that they worked within cliques that were not open to foreign influences. The story of the dealers who were expelled from Paris and never came back stop here. The stories of dealers who came back continues. The question is which city they came back to. If personal networks were interrupted from 1914 to 1918, also the street network of Paris changed. Buildings are social objects in that they are invested with social meaning and shape social relation. An article published in 1913 in the Gazette Drouot retraced the geographical history of the Parisian art trade. First, the antiquarians were grouped close to the main auction house, and then they moved to the Rive Gauche and then conquered the Champs-Élysées. By 1918, the geography of the city had been irreversibly modified by physical destruction. More than any other main belligerent, France suffered from physical destruction on its soil, and Paris was hit too. The traditional art world arrondissements, the 9th, the 10th, and the 18th, were defaced. So on the slide, you can see one of the art trade streets destroyed by German bombs. I retrieved this image from a digital archive, and there are digital archives on war damages from the city of Paris available online. The war had made of what were business neighbors before 1914, enemies after the summer of the same year, thus changing completely the urban dynamics of the city for German-speaking dealers. The interesting question is, where did the dealers who came back to Paris settle down? So I do not know that exactly, but I think that by studying the dynamics of their movements, one could get an understanding for how foreign capital came back and placed itself again in the new geography of Paris. Recent cartographic analysis by Léa Saint-Raymond with her Artlas database used simple sources such as commercial address books to reconstruct a geography of the Parisian art market between 1855 and 1955. The benefits of charting the geography of the art market in Paris lie in providing a valuable historical reconstruction of the spaces in which business was done and therefore, consequently, also where capital moved and was situated in the city. In line with this approach, tracking the movements of foreign dealers in Paris could provide an understanding for how businesses set up by non-French dealers developed from 1900 to 1914, and then compare and contrast these results with those for the years 1914 to 1925. This would first of all allow to track a geography of non-French dealerships in the first decade of the 20th century, and together with an analysis of sales, it could help us to understand how foreign money shaped the streets of Paris. So some final remarks. This paper showed the consequences of appropriating and losing foreign capital by pointing mainly at the breakdown of international networks and placing this episode within the stagnation of the French art market post 1914. As a case study, it reflected on the expulsion from a voluntary exile of a foreign community in Paris. Jacques Derrida writes that cities are places of hospitality in the age of migration, referring to the 20th century. But I think this case shows how quickly cities can change and become the opposite of hospital, much unlike actually other places and spaces. Cosmopolitanism is fragile in urban space. Interestingly, what allowed the way to expropriate German-speaking dealers right after the outbreak of the war was the fact that they were embedded in a network of street that was easy to control and offers many opportunity to present-day historian. This paper argued for the use of address and commercial books as a way to track the movements and the influence of a foreign community on a urban space. It showed how sale records can be used to track and reconstruct the presence of a community in a city, and can allow historians to quantify the consequences of its absence. Provide the material for a less personal type of history than the memoirs, which I quoted at the beginning of this talk. Yet, they also offer opportunities to look at the expulsion and exile from a different, more interdisciplinary perspective. I believe that this episode is an interesting case study for the interconnectedness of cultural, business, and urban life. I tried to encompass as much material as possible in 15 minutes, which meant I had to simplify a lot of much more complex material, but I'm very happy to elaborate on some themes I've introduced, receive criticism, feedback, and any remark that might help to improve the paper. And I'm just very happy to engage in a conversation with you, and thank you very much.